A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program, and looking forward to having our conversation with Joe Laporto, NRA ILA representative for New Hampshire here in just a second, among other states, I should mention. This was a frustrating session in New Hampshire. You know, it's frustrating session in a lot of states. I mean, I live in Virginia, where we saw just an avalanche of gun control legislation introduced. New Hampshire, though, you got a pro-gun governor, you got a pro-gun majority in the Senate, you got a pro-gun majority in the House. So you've got all of the building blocks in place to have pro-gun legislation become pro-gun laws. That didn't happen this session. Campus carry did not make it to the governor's desk. You had a preemption bill that New Hampshire already has firearms preemption, but this would have strengthened it, would have made it impossible for state agencies to implement gun control regulations. That didn't make it to the governor's desk. And this is frustrating. So I wanted to ask Joe, you know, what happened here? Now that the session is over, to look back and to, you know, try to figure out, okay, well, what went wrong and what can we do so that New Hampshire gun owners, if they still have that pro-Second Amendment trifecta next session, what can they do to actually advance legislation, get these bills to the finish line? It's a frustrating conversation. I wish we didn't have to have it, but it was a, I think, a really good conversation with Joe Laporto. Take a look and a listen. Joe, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's really good to see you, sir.
Morning, Cam. Great to be back. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you bet. And this was a frustrating session for New Hampshire gun owners, I think. We had several good bills. We have a pro-gun legislature. I think it's fair to say that is the case. And yet we saw both campus carry and this bill that would sort of add to the state's preemption law. Neither one of those bills made it across the finish line this session. So can we talk about what happened, Joe?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we did, you know, as we put into the press last week, I mean, we did voice our, you know, our disappointment in the fact that we closed out 2 years of a biennium with a trifecta government, and didn't quite get the gains that we would have hoped to achieve under those circumstances. I do think, you know, as you say, New Hampshire is a very pro-gun state with a very pro-gun legislature. You know, and I think part of the reality is that it is quite pro-gun, so there's not this big panoply of issues to deal with. We did, however, you know, circle up some legislative priorities that deal with the residual issues that in a place like New Hampshire, right? We circled up some distinct policy areas that are impacting people negatively in an otherwise pro-gun state. And those two bills that you mentioned, HB 609 and HB 1793, those bills are intimately tied together, right? It is a pro-gun legislature. So, for example, there's no statute in New Hampshire that regulates certain types of conduct. The legislature just simply wouldn't pass such a thing. But as in any state, you know, and we've certainly seen examples of that in other, you know, quote unquote pro-gun, you know, red states, there is often areas for abuse inside state agencies or at the municipal level or with quasi, you know, governmental entities like the University of New Hampshire.
Right.
There's no statutory basis for that. But nonetheless, there are areas that are negatively impacting folks. So, you know, we looked across that and looked at some of those key issues. And what do you see? There are some simple areas where there's abuse, right? The Department of Environmental Services in New Hampshire through a combination of what we view as inappropriate rules and some internal policies, they treat indoor shooting ranges differently than other regulated businesses. Not because of statutory authority, but just because there's room for discretion inside these enabling statutes that allows, you know, agencies like that to get away with those things. And that is a prime time example. There could be a perfectly proper reason to do something differently as it relates to an indoor shooting range. But if it's allowed to happen at just the discretion of a bureaucrat, you can see the obvious areas for abuse with that. Similarly, there's a lot of state agencies that through internal policymaking, which completely escapes the rule and statutory framework of the state, that regulate, for example, employee conduct. So famously, and it came up a lot during discussion on the bill in committee hearings, you know, there's plow drivers working in the middle of the night in New Hampshire that through internal policies are unable to protect themselves. And then finally, and obviously the biggest and most contentious part of this is the University of New Hampshire, the community college system of New Hampshire, through just their own internal policymaking, restricts the rights of both students and faculty to carry on campus, despite the fact that there's no statutory authority for that at all. There's no state law that prohibits that. And so it's sort of in contravention of the statutory intent as it relates to those kinds of places. So despite the fact that we are a very pro-gun state, you know, we have areas where, you know, we're creating gun-free zones with no statutory basis. We're regulating employee conduct despite the fact that there's no compelling public safety objective. And there are examples of agencies that kind of can go off the rails occasionally despite the fact that the legislation and the legislative environment is relatively favorable. So in a broad and universal way, we were trying to address all of that. The preemption and campus carry, those two concepts are intimately tied, right? In both instances, you can think of the campus carry bill as really being a discrete subset of the preemption concept here.
Okay.
You know, broad extending that policy to encapsulate a broader collection of entities beyond just political subdivisions.
So what was... I'm sorry. I was just gonna say. I mean, so what was the hangup ultimately, and was it the same issue that you dealt with? Because the campus carry bill stalled out, I think is maybe the best way to put it, before the preemption bill. It had passed out of the House, went over to the Senate. There was some disagreement. There were some amendments, and then it was a matter of, okay, will the House accept those amendments? Will it go to a conference committee? And ultimately, the answer was no. It would not even go to a conference committee. The House did not accept the Senate's changes, but apparently didn't even want to work with the Senate to try to find some common ground. What was the issue there? And then was that the same issue that sort of derailed the preemption bill in the waning days of the session?
Well, if you really look at our strategy behind this whole initiative, you know, campus carry is a difficult topic. There are 11 states that have passed this. Again, even in very pro-gun friendly states, I mean, it is a difficult topic to deal with. You know, famously, Wyoming passed a relatively clean bill, but then in the end, they included a restriction that requires that students have a Wyoming carry permit. Despite the fact that Wyoming is a constitutional carry state, the problem there is that you have to be 21 and up to get a Wyoming carry permit, and non-residents can't get them. So by adding that one simple provision, you alienate a huge swath of the student population at universities in Wyoming. It's always going to be a difficult issue. There are some unique features that make life on a campus unique. Notably, the one that was probably most contentious over the session was the issue of how do you deal with students cohabitating in dorm rooms where there's no real, you know, division of like, where's my property? Where's your property? It's sort of all shared space. And so how do you ensure that students are properly storing their firearms when they're not in their possession? How do you deal with the dorm issue? And 11 of 11 states that have passed it have some restrictions, if not outright bans of possession of firearms in dorms, which for us is a deal breaker. At the end of the day, the House was reluctant to negotiate on campus carry. And so the constant signaling that any discussion around these policy areas, any quote unquote watering down of the House bill, which was essentially just a blank check on the issue, was going to be rejected by the House. I mean, our Senate partners were working really hard on advancing the issue, but ultimately it was this tension between the House and the Senate. And look, to be perfectly honest, New Hampshire is a unique place. For those that don't know, the New Hampshire lower chamber is the third largest legislative body in the world.
Right.
With 400 members and a caucus with over 200 members, you know, it is a it if you think of Washington, D.C. as a difficult place to do business, there's a lot less resources to whipping House members in New Hampshire. So it is a little bit of a Wild West environment.
Yeah.
In the House, and that makes working on these kinds of issues difficult. And for that reason, it does sometimes take a session or two, you know, to advance the ball on something like this.
I'm sorry, I hate to interrupt, but when you talk about this being the House version being sort of a blank check, not a lot of details in there. You brought up the dorm issue. That's one. I know that, you know, other issues, a lot of college campuses will have places that genuinely are, you know, quote unquote, sensitive places, right? If you've got a hospital setting, for instance, you don't want somebody to be able to bring a gun into the room where, you know, the magnetic imaging is taking place, right? That's just bad news. Right. So, you know, then, you know, we've seen, states like West Virginia and others wrestle with, okay, well, what do we do with, you know, the football games? What do we do with the basketball arenas? You know, places where there is going to be a law enforcement presence, there may be magnetometers present. You know, there are some nuances, I think it's fair to say.
Some of the amendment language that, you know, I think was necessary on the House bill was in part there to also protect gun owners, right? For example, at UNH, there are nested high school campuses. Those are federally defined as gun-free zones. And so because New Hampshire is a constitutional carry state, how do we deal with this entrapment issue? Like, we're declaring the campus free for carrying. How do you ensure that, you know, those students don't necessarily inadvertently run afoul of federal law? Now, as a general matter, as you know, the DOJ is, generally speaking, you know, not proactively enforcing those restrictions. And if you have a carry permit, again, as you know, you can become exempt from the gun-free zone restrictions, the federal restrictions. However, like, how do you deal with that? That's an important aspect of this. And when you've got, you know, let's say UNH is not necessarily friendly to the idea that they have to start allowing this to happen, and we've got federal gun-free zones, there are areas where we're concerned about entrapment problems.
Right.
And so it does make the issue complicated. There's no question it's a complicated issue. And a simple one-liner bill that just says students can carry, end of story, is just simply never going to work. And so it was a complicated session. Like most states, it's not a full year session, so we have a compressed, limited amount of time to deal with it. The crossover date comes up quickly, and then, you know, we're kind of scrambling to get as much done in the session as possible. I don't want to fault the legislature too much on this. You know, the Senate is extremely supportive. We have excellent relationships. Senator Carson is the Senate president, did a ton of work on this bill. Senator Abbas did a ton of work on both of these bills. You know, the time ran out for us, and an election year just generally makes this complicated.
Yeah.
So,
well, yeah, I mean, you know, because again, I mean, we talk about, you know, it's not like anti-gun opposition killed these bills. You had, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, I think you had two groups of pro-Second Amendment lawmakers who could not get on the same page.
Correct.
Is that fair to say?
That's fair to say. I mean, in fairness, you know, just to sort of dovetail the two, right? Yeah. We knew the campus carry was going to be difficult. It might push us into a subsequent session. And that's why we pursued the language changes in the preemption bill that we insisted on, because you never want to just let legislators punt the issue into another session, right? Because that's an empty promise, right? What happens next year is in part predicated on the election, you know, and there's a lot of factors to that. But if you look at the sort of the nuance behind the way we expanded the preemption language over the session, the preemption bill included University of New Hampshire and the entire USNH system.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it put a timer on the expiration of the policies that were implicated here. So in other words, we would have been forced to get a relatively comprehensive campus carry bill done next session, because in the absence of that, the policies at UNH would have simply stopped existing in year three. So the preemption bill language that we worked on here was in some way, in the intent was to create a ramp to get us to a complete and comprehensive bill in the next session that would properly address those issues. It's part of the reason why we're so disappointed that there was ultimately resistance within the party on our preemption bill, because it's so at the NRA here, I think the difference is our goals are to promote good policy. And in order to promote good policy, it needs to have two things critically. It needs to properly address the issues, and it needs to be something that can endure and survive legal challenges.
Yeah.
Right. We're not the anti-gunners, right? That is what Giffords in every town does. They write nonsense on paper, pass it, you know, with a Democrat caucus that just simply doesn't want to do the work and is just willing to carry water for those organizations, regardless of what they write. You know, we see that with some of these quote unquote machine gun conversion device bills. Some of those are so poorly written. We've made the point, you know, in Senate and House hearings on those bills, that the way this bill is, regardless of our position on the issue, the way this bill is written, no prosecutor can enforce this. They frankly don't care, right? They just don't care. Their goal is to score brownie points in public and not affect good policy.
Yeah.
And our view is different on that. We need good policy, and that's our goal in everything that we do.
So with the preemption bill, you know, I know that the Attorney General had come out and said, "Hey, don't vote for this." This, you know, Attorney General said well intended, but thinks it would, you know, create more problems than it would solve. You'd have because this would have left the legislature. First, it would have been up to like a committee to go through the rules for all of the state agencies, right, and get rid of the ones that violated our Second Amendment rights, make sure that they were in compliance with preemption. I frankly don't necessarily agree with the Attorney General's position on that this would, you know, create more problems. I think this is how you solve problems, but you know, the bottom line is this bill too did not make it to the finish line. As you say, we've got elections coming up in November. I think I don't want to read too many tea leaves, but I feel pretty confident that the state Senate is going to stay in Republican hands. You talk about the House being as large as it is, you can see some pretty wild, vote swings in any given, session. So knock on wood, you still have a pro-gun majority, next year. You know, is this, if you still have Republicans in control, let's say you got a Republican trifecta again, have you started thinking about, okay, what can I do here to get these lawmakers on the same page, or at least in the same room, to start talking about these things and to hash out the differences so that we can come up with a bill that, as you say, improves policy, is going to withstand a legal challenge, and again, ultimately will be beneficial to the exercise of our Second Amendment rights?
Well, I mean, the work that we left here in the session is not the end. You know, this is merely the beginning. You know, we evolved the policy over the course of the session. The fact that we're moving into the next it doesn't mean that the work that we did in this session is over. You know, as with everything, it's about building consensus and unifying a caucus. And you have to start taking steps in that direction to try to find where those areas of contention are. You know, as they say, like, you know, you're over the target when you start getting flack, right? And we started getting flack from every direction on this. And obviously, we're a little disappointed with the Attorney General. Generally speaking, this administration is a fairly pro-gun, you know, legislation. Kelly Ayotte's been a strong defender of the Second Amendment. And even the Attorney General has done favorable things. But if you read his letter, part of their opposition was, well, we are a pro-gun administration, and this flexibility that we currently have gives us the opportunity to do nice things for gun owners. And that, in fact, is the entire problem and the point of our legislation, right? At the end of the day,
right,
our rights should not be subject to the policy preferences or whims of a given bureaucrat. And we publicly responded to the Attorney General. So is it uncommon for division heads to want to defend their turf when we're dealing with these kinds of issues, even a relatively favorable administration? Yeah, that's certainly possible. And as we saw here, there was some dispute. The Senate read that letter from the Attorney General and they voted accordingly. You know, the House was a little more divided, so that's clearly an issue that we need to work on in the next session.
Yeah. What can New Hampshire gun owners be doing right now, Joe?
I mean, first of all, I think it's true for gun owners across the United States. We really need to be paying close attention to these elections and making sure we're getting to the polls in November. you know, there's been a lot of discussion over the session of what NRA does or doesn't do as it relates to the election. And let me clear the air on that. There are no passes from the NRA. At the end of the day, we're going to look at the voting records of all of these members, both House and Senate, and all participants. And whether it's a bill that we supported or sponsored or not, if it touches the Second Amendment, we're going to reflect that in voting records. And so our goal is to try to educate folks on where the weaknesses are in the legislature and get them to vote accordingly. You know, I think there is also in states that are perceived to be safe, you know, there is a degree of recalcitrance amongst gun owners. You know, you think like, oh, I don't have to worry about this. And I think everyone in the country should be taking note of exactly what happens when things go the wrong way. If we look at Virginia, give them 30 days in office and look what they'll do. If you think you're safe because my perception is that we've got a favorable legislature, or my perception is, well, the Senate's likely to retain its position in the election, I would caution and warn everyone out there, don't get lazy in this election. This is going to be a tough a tough midterm for governors and legislatures across the country, and no one is safe. Yeah. So we need to be more proactive now than I think we ever were in the past.
I think you're right about that. And as a Virginian, I will tell gun owners and friendly states like New Hampshire, you're exactly right, Joe. Things can turn on a dime, and if the anti-gunners are in a position to change the gun laws, they're not taking baby steps right now. They're doing everything they can to completely revamp and overhaul a state's gun laws. We went from a state with, pretty good gun laws. We didn't have permitless carry. We had permitless open carry. That was one of the few things that was actually left untouched this session. But, we saw 13 major gun control bills signed into law by Governor Abigail Spanberger. There were a number of others that were sort of left on the table. They're going to come back next year. They turned Virginia in from a pretty good state into South New Jersey or New York, in a matter of months.
There truly is no middle ground.
Yeah.
And another issue that we encountered in the session was some contention between some of the quote unquote pro gun groups in the state, and it's actually an issue that the weekend prior, we were all at the New England Firearms Advocacy Conference. Mm-hmm. And so myself and Bill Sack from Second Amendment Foundation, we sort of sat on a panel discussing, how national organizations work with state organizations. And I think the gist and the tone of that panel was really that, we need to be better coordinated. We don't see Giffords and Everytown and Bloomberg sponsored organizations in tension with each other, right? They are our opponents are never at each other's throats. Our opponents are exceptionally well coordinated and synchronized on the issues.
Oh, yeah.
And at the state and national level, we can't be breaking ranks on critical stuff like this. And I think that was in part a failure here.
Yeah.
And another reason why we had a squandered biennium. But our work doesn't end. We'll be back next session. We've got, as you say, we've got a strong likelihood that there will be ways to advance policy in the next session, irrespective of the outcome of the election. We're hoping that that's going to remain the case. But my caution to gun owners would be, don't get lazy.
Yeah. And show up on election day. Joe, as always, man, I really appreciate you joining us on the program. Thank you for everything you're doing. I'm looking forward to seeing you in Massachusetts this coming weekend for the Gold 250 event in Boxborough. And safe travels there. And I'll see you in a few days.
Safe travels to you as well.
My thanks once again to Joe for joining us on the program, and I hope that next session is a better one in New Hampshire. And I understand, again, the desire to get as good as Bill as possible. I have that same desire. But sometimes that means you get 80% of what you want. It means you don't get 100% of what you want. And if the choice is between, okay, I'm going to get 80% of what I want this session, or 0% of what I want this session, that to me seems like a no-brainer, right? You go with the 80% and then you work on the other 20% next year. Gun control groups do that all the time. It doesn't matter if they are making the most incremental progress possible. As long as they're making progress, they're happy with that, because they know they can always go back next year, right? I mean, look at what we're seeing with the fight over so-called assault bans. In Colorado, they wanted to ban him outright. This was last session. Jared Polis said, no, I'm not going to do that. How about a permit to purchase instead? Gun control groups, they grumbled. They went along with it. And you know what? Governor Polis, he's term limited. He's out. And if a Democrat governor, takes over from him in Colorado, doesn't have the objection to a ban on so-called assault weapons, then lawmakers are going to pass one. And they'll be happy to do it. Okay, fine. So we had this permit to purchase system in place for a couple of years. Well, now we got the ban we wanted. We saw this in Rhode Island last session. They passed a ban on the sale, the manufacture, the transfer of so-called assault weapons. And then this year, the sponsor comes back and says, well, we need to ban the possession. If you already owned one, you got to get rid of it. Should have done that last year, but we didn't have the votes for it. Well, we want to try it for the votes this year. So I don't believe that you can let perfect be the enemy of good. That I think is, you know, one issue. And, you know, another issue is, and I don't know if this is specific. In fact, I don't even know how big an issue this was in New Hampshire. Certainly the attorney general coming in and saying, hey, you should vote against this measure. That doesn't help. But as we've seen in Florida, you know, sometimes you're going to have leadership that does not want to lift a finger to pass pro-Second Amendment legislation. I don't think that was the issue in New Hampshire, but it is an issue that folks living in pro-Second Amendment states do have to deal with. And again, it goes back to the importance of elections. You know, electing people who will, it doesn't matter if they've got an R or a D behind their name, if they're not going to stand up for your Second Amendment rights, we don't want them, right? We want politicians who are going to support our right to keep and bear arms, are going to fight to advance and secure our right to keep and bear arms. And it sounds like we could use a few more of those, not just, you know, willing to say they are Second Amendment supporters, but willing to put their money where their mouth is, not just in New Hampshire, but again, states like Florida. Thank goodness we've got Attorney General James Uthmeyer, who is doing a fantastic job of doing what the legislature will not. Hopefully we'll be talking, by the way, with the Florida Attorney General in the coming days here on Bearing Arms, Scam and Company. All right, right now, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen Story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a case out of Lewiston, Maine. I actually wrote about what's going on in Lewiston for Bearing Arms earlier today. You know, Lewiston and the mass shooting there in 2023, that was the impetus for all of the gun control laws that we've seen pass in Maine since. The red flag law, the pass via voter referendum, waiting periods, expanded background checks. None of those would have passed, I think, were it not for the mass shooting in Lewiston. And yet, what Lewiston is dealing with right now is not one mass shooting, but a series of shootings. They've had 16 shootings since January 1st. At least 10 of those have involved juveniles. In May, there were 27 individuals arrested for firearm-related crimes. 20 of them were underage. Now, again, Democrats are going to try to make this about gun control. Well, we need storage laws. We need, maybe a 7-day waiting period, lost or stolen firearms legislation, right? They'll come up with a wave of bills targeting lawful gun owners when lawful gun owners aren't the issue. And actually, there was a guy, the youth coordinator for the Lewiston Police Department, who talked about, I see the same faces. And a lot of times these kids will get arrested. They won't even go to trial. They'll maybe do a day in juvenile detention, and then they're back out on the streets. And so they have this attitude like, what's the big deal? What are you going to do to me? Because all too often the answer is nothing, right? Case in point, headline from Central Maine News. Lewiston teen accused of tossing gun while being chased by police. A 17-year-old on probation discarded a .45 caliber handgun during a foot chase before he was arrested on Friday morning, according to police. Central Maine News says officers were patrolling shortly after 2 a.m. on June the 5th, said they encountered a juvenile and determined that he was violating the city's curfew ordinance. And again, if there's no teeth to that, what teenager's going to care? While they're investigating, the teen ran off during the chase. He apparently, again, threw this .45 caliber handgun that he was carrying. They apprehended the suspect, did recover the firearm. According to police, on juvenile probation, they don't say what for, but they did say that he has previously been charged with nearly a dozen offenses, including multiple felonies. He's 17 years old. Now he's charged with possession of a firearm by a prohibited person, falsifying physical evidence, carrying a concealed weapon, refusal to submit to arrest or detention, a probation hold, and a curfew violation. This is exactly what the youth coordinator for the Lewiston PD was talking about. An individual who's well known to law enforcement, nearly a dozen offenses that he's been charged with, multiple felonies, and yet he's on probation at 17. And that's more than a lot of these teens get, because a lot of times these cases don't even go to trial. A judge will toss out the charges based on their age, based on, you know, past trauma. Basically, you know, they didn't know what they were doing, so they can't be held accountable for their crimes. It is a recipe for disaster. And I think it's also a recipe for more gun control, because I think the Democrats in charge of the legislature in Maine are not likely to look at this and say, all right, we got to crack down on juvenile offenses. I think they're going to say, hey, look, this gives us another excuse to go after lawful gun owners. And I think we're going to see a lot of that coming up next session in Maine. Today's Armed Citizen story from Hawaii, where the Honolulu Police Department has determined that a man acted in self-defense after originally being charged with murder. According to the Honolulu police, this 21-year-old man was previously arrested for second-degree murder in connection with the fatal shooting of a 19-year-old man during an alleged robbery last Thursday, did in fact act in self-defense. Murder charges were declined after the case was sent to the Department of the Prosecuting Attorney. According to the Honolulu Star-Advertiser, detectives from the Homicide and Strategic Enforcement Detail determined that the victim and another 20-year-old man approached a group of individuals who were gathered in the open garage of a residence where a dice game was going on. This was shortly before midnight back on June the 4th. The victim demanded money and property while threatening those present with a firearm. The victim, in this case, is the person who got shot, but not really a victim. The second man also demanded property. During the incident, according to the Honolulu Police Department, a struggle occurred over the firearm, and the victim, quote-unquote, was shot and died at the scene. A 21-year-old man was identified as the suspect and turned himself into the local police station. He was arrested for suspicion of second-degree murder. Upon further investigation, police said that three juvenile males, ages 14, 15, and 17, were also participants in the robbery before the shooting. And after the shooting, the three teens took property that had been stolen. The 14-year-old arrested for four counts of first-degree robbery. The 15-year-old and 17-year-old boys arrested for second-degree theft and first-degree hindering prosecution. The 21-year-old man who allegedly participated in the robbery was charged with four counts of first-degree robbery. And again, the individual who shot the would-be robber and who was arrested on charges of second-degree murder is not going to be facing charges, because it turns out he was the victim of the crime. He was one of the intended victims of this robbery, who acted in self-defense when getting a hold of the robber's firearm. Why he was arrested in the first place? You got me. Seems to me like this would have been a fairly easy thing to determine, if not right there at the scene, certainly not long afterwards. And I guess, you know, it's 4 days since this event occurred, and he has already been cleared, so maybe it isn't all that long in the grand scheme of things, but yeah, it seems like that should have been a matter of hours to determine, not a matter of days. Finally, today, our good deed of the day in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A good Samaritan in Florida who helped three teens after a jet ski crashed into a tree on Lake Hiawatha, and the good Samaritan in a position to help these kids out of the water. This was in Lake County. Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission reporting on the incident. Happened last Tuesday at Lake Hiawatha. Three kids, again, on a jet ski. They hit a tree that was submerged, and all of them ended up in the water. Nearby boater spotted the aftermath, went to help. His name is Rich Charleston. Said he and his family were returning home by boat after dinner, when they noticed people on shore who were waving for help. And he said, as we got closer, I saw the jet ski at the base of a tree, three kids in the water. At first, he thought the kids were sort of stranded there in the water. And then as he got closer, he realized, oh, no, these kids are hurt. He said, I saw the front of the jet ski destroyed when I saw the giant tree trunk. Charleston is a former firefighter. And he said one of the teens appeared to be seriously injured. He was drifting in and out of consciousness while the other teens were trying to keep his head above water. So Charleston jumped into the water, helped move the injured teen onto his boat, assisted the others until first responders arrived. Two of the three teens were taken to a local hospital. One was later released with a broken leg. Another remains hospitalized but is improving and is expected to recover. Rich Charleston said that he believes getting there within minutes of the crash may have made a critical difference. He said a lot of that time is crucial. It could have had a very different outcome. So in the right place, at the right time, willing able to do the right thing. Rich Charleston, we thank you for your very, very good deed. Now, that is all the time we've got for you on this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the program. I'm looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. We're going to be talking with Toby Leary from Cape Gunworks from the Civil Rights Coalition up in Massachusetts. Toby, by the way, will also be at the Goal 250 event in Boxborough, Massachusetts this weekend. So Joe Laporto is going to be there. John Comerford, NRA ILA Executive Director, is going to be there. Adam Crowd from Second Amendment Foundation will be there. I will be there. I would love for you to be there as well. Goal250.org, that's the website. You can get your tickets. It's going to be a great night celebrating the 250th anniversary of the United States of America and the continued fight to regain our Second Amendment freedoms in Massachusetts. So hopefully we'll see you there as well. But hopefully I'll see you back here tomorrow, the Tuesday edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. Until then, be well, be safe, be free.